You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
It's a superb group of people, and we're very honored to have been able to support Brookings in this effort. So thanks again to Brookings, to Norm, to my staff for having helped support Brookings in this effort. It's really marvelous. It's great to see so many people here, too, who probably should be on the stage, in addition to the great folks that have been on the stage, like Meredith and Larry and Sheila. John Rao has, you know, been a champion of this cause for a long time, so we'll have to do this again at some point. So we're here to talk about why the time is now. And I just talked to Congressman Sarbanes and said, in addition to talking about why the time is now, we would love to hear specifics of what people think is needed to create the type of momentum and velocity necessary to create a legislating majority on behalf of this issue. We see a lot of indications that that kind of velocity is picking up. There have been 600 anti-Citizens United resolutions passed over the course of the last 6 years. That's really significant. We see in poll after poll that 80 to 90% of Americans think this is a big problem, but we also see in a Pew poll from about 3 months ago that the intensity is increasing also. In fact, in that Pew poll, when people were asked what the number one dysfunction with government was, they said corruption as a result of money's influence. So we see rising heat in the public. We see all kinds of new efforts popping up. I think that John Putner's Take Back Our Republic is a great example of something that just come out of the blue sky, and John is such a force of nature, so we all want to support you as best as we can to begin doing the kind of organizing that hasn't been on this issue that's critical to it. I want to just read one thing that I think my staff has heard me read before, so they're probably going to roll their eyes in the back, but I feel like one of the things that powers me as I work on this cause is the tremendous audaciousness and idealism that fueled the revolution. And I stumbled across this passage from the Massachusetts state constitution that John Adams himself crafted in 1780. So, and then the Massachusetts charter actually served as inspiration and a guide for the U.S. Constitution. So here's this part that I love. Part 1, Article 7 of the Massachusetts Charter reads, "Government is instituted for the common good, for the protection, safety, prosperity, and happiness of the people, and not, now I love this, and not for the profit, honor, or private interest of any one man, family, or class of men. Therefore, the people alone have an incontestable, unalienable, and indefeasible right to institute government and to reform, alter, or totally change the same when their protection, safety, prosperity, and happiness require it." I mean, that's just, you know, given the historical trends that they were facing, given the massive might of the British Empire, the fact that they put those words in writing, and not only put them in writing, but by God instituted them and created a nation based on that idealistic principle, will forever give me goosebumps. And I just want to remind us all that that's, you know, the one thing that unites us, why we're all sitting here in this room. The other thing I want to say is that this town is toxic on this issue. I've lived in Washington for 11 years now, mostly as a journalist, a magazine publisher, a reporter. I've been doing this work for 4 years. And you ask anyone in this town about money and politics, and you get one of two responses, basically. One is this kind of patronizing, "Oh, you poor soul," look. Like, God, you poor sucker. Like, I can't believe you're doing something so impossible. The other one is people will say, you know, that's really important. God bless you. And they'll give you a pat on the back. But what you don't get is, you're goddamn right. What can I do for you? It's time. Let's get mobilizing. Let's go. So I can't tell you how important this kind of a forum is with the kind of firepower that we have in this room to begin changing the tenor and nature and temperature on this issue in this town. I agree that we will need a grassroots movement. That's absolutely necessary. But as most of the people who live here know, the thickness of the glass on the fishbowl that is Washington is so thick that unless we also are warming up the oven here, that grassroots movement will bounce up against that glass and fall backwards. So it's a both-and scenario. It's both build on the outside and also change the dynamic on the inside. So to carry this conversation forward, I have a wonderful guest with me, John Sarbanes, Claudine Schneider, Zephyr Teachout, you can read their bios. Many of you probably already know them. We're going to start with John, because he, of any member of Congress, is out talking to people about this issue, beating the bushes on this issue, stirring up energy on this issue, has wonderful stories to tell and a great perspective. So, John, take it away.
Thanks, Nick, and I want to thank everybody for being here for a full day on this subject. I wasn't here earlier, but I heard that the discussion has been terrific and enlightening and brought kind of new angles of understanding and prisms of understanding to this issue that's not just gripping the country, but increasingly is gripping Congress and gripping this city. I'm pleased to be here with Senator Schneider and with Zephyr Teachout. I want to thank Nick and Issue One for all the great work that they're doing to bring this issue to the fore and put it in front of not just audiences like this one, but really put it in front of the country. I gather there was a lot of discussion earlier about the problem, and I think we can just stipulate at this point to the problem and the fact that the deep cynicism, anger, and frustration out there in the country cuts broadly across the political spectrum. Every town hall I have, and I begin every town hall with this topic, turns into a group therapy session within about 5 minutes. Because once people are actually convinced that you do want to hear from them, they sort of let it all out. So we know what the problem is. The question is, what is the solution? Donald Trump would have you believe that the solution to the problem of money in politics and its undue influence is to elect him because he doesn't know anybody. James Madison, who I view, I said this to someone earlier today, as a more reliable source of good thinking on our democracy, would say that the solution is to make government dependent upon the people alone, to build systems of financing campaigns that really do depend upon the public and the people and everyday citizens out there. The beauty of that is not only do you cure the situation of undue influence operating in Washington, but you address the deep cynicism and frustration that people feel, because if they see themselves in the solution, then they will have hope again. So I think exploring these alternative ways of empowering people at a time when they feel so kind of frustrated and left out and locked out of their own democracy, that's where we have to put our attention. We are seeing at the state and local level efforts like in Maine and in Seattle and other places that reflect that people are willing to take this anger in a constructive direction. And I'm going to run out of time in a moment, but I want to bring your attention to the fact that on or about November 3rd, there was a poll that was conducted by the Wall Street Journal, Wall Street Journal, I think, NBC poll. And in it, 7 out of 10 Americans said they agreed with the statement, "I feel angry because our political system seems to be only working for the insiders with money and power like those on Wall Street or in Washington." And that was pretty upsetting to see. But on that same day, November 3rd, in Seattle and in Maine, everyday citizens were taking that anger and frustration and channeling it into positive solutions that are restorative of the democracy. So people are angry, but they're starting to take control again and do things that are constructive and hopeful for the democracy. And that's why I have so much hope and why I do believe that the time is now. Thank you.
No question but the time is now. But I would like to see a show of hands. How many in this room consider themselves, and hopefully you've done some personal reflection, how many of you are optimists? Okay, you all now have an assignment to carry the ball on this issue and whatever else you're working on. I had the good fortune of teaching at Harvard for a bit, and I had a plethora of students, undergraduate, graduate, including some from the community. And I was very curious because I was supposed to be teaching leadership, and I thought, my God, you know, I think I know how to do it, but in terms of teaching it, this is something else again. And I did this experiential survey, and I found out that those people who consider themselves optimists. I started the class by saying, I'd like the optimist to sit on this side of the room, the pessimist on that side of the room. And I said, don't worry about it. I'm taking a mental photograph of who's who, and we'll follow up later. Overwhelmingly, the optimists were able to execute a number of different projects without, I mean, there were some difficulties, but they were the successful ones. So that is my scientific research I wanted to share with all of you today, that if you believe you can do it, you can do it. And I have spent my life, my career, being told I can't fight cancer, I can't fight City Hall, I can't do this, I can't do that. Well, guess what? I've proven the odds wrong. And that is why I'm very selective in what I do with my time and my energy. And I am very grateful to Nick, to David, to Gabrielle, and the team at Issue One for inviting me to be part of this initiative, because this is a winning initiative. And all initiatives have to focus on two things, the message and the messenger. Now, when I introduced the Global Warming Prevention Act, which was the first revenue-neutral bill on climate change in 1988, I had 140 co-sponsors before I dropped the bill. Thank you very much. And we got portions of that bill passed. And people said, can't be done, but we got portions of it through. Well, this initiative that we're involved in here, campaign finance reform, also does not require a silver bullet. It's not just overturning Citizens United. It's all the different strategies that have been articulated here today, and then some that we may not have even thought of as yet. So the bottom line is that galvanize around whatever approach, strategy you feel you can win with. And I happen to believe that Issue One is embarking on one that collectively we will make a difference. Now, quickly, I have 30 seconds. How many members of the media are here? 3, 4, 5? Really, guys? Okay, well, thanks a lot. Really? Okay, but this is an issue for the media, because we can talk in closed rooms all we want, but if we don't get this message out to the masses that there are solutions, leave your cynicism at the door, we're going to make a difference here. Each of you who held up your hands at the outset saying you're optimists, I now charge each of you to write an op-ed page to whatever media outlet you choose, and let's get the job done, because united we stand, divided we fall. We can make this happen. Thank you.
I guess you guys are stuck with a couple of professors, because I also have an assignment. I'm a law professor. We use the Socratic method. Write down the percentage, at least in your brain, chance that you think we can have public financing in over half the states within the next 6 years. Write down, at least in your brain, the percentage chance that you think we can have a constitutional amendment in the next 10 years. Okay. Now we get to the fun part. Dan, what percentage chance did you think that Donald Trump would be leading in the polls a year ago today, on the 5th anniversary of Citizens United? What percentage chance did you think that Bernie Sanders would be leading as against Hillary Clinton in two states? What percentage chance did you think that the Comcast-Time Warner merger would be stopped? Now, my guess is that all of you would write down numbers on those three things, Bernie, Trump, and the Comcast-Time Warner merger, that are even lower than your little 3%, 5% number that you wrote down on public financing. So the reason the time is now is the pundits are wrong, and they keep being wrong about the same kind of thing. Okay? They were wrong. I'm sitting on a table with a couple of winners. I did not win in my campaign for governor. But I did start out with an 8% name recognition and 18% of people not liking me. Figure that out. are great, right? And ended up with 32% in a three-month period. And I give my team a lot of credit, but I will tell you the reason the pundits were wrong and thought we weren't going to get over 8% is because they radically underestimated the particular political moment we are in right now. It's not just the Pew poll showing intensity. You know it. You feel it. You feel that incredible anger. So here is your job. And by the way, we now have two presidential candidates that are running on campaign finance reform. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. I don't agree with Donald Trump's campaign finance reform proposal. It's basically have only billionaires run the country. But it is a campaign finance proposal. And I actually, you know, with Bernie Sanders, I'm with him on Citizens United. I'm with him on building a grassroots movement. But I wish he talked about public financing a lot more, right? But, you know, both of the candidates who are winning are all about this thing. Comcast Time Warner was not just about Comcast Time Warner. It was about Comcast having way too much power in Washington, D.C., and that's why so many people got together and tried to stop that. So here is your job. Your job is just to stop saying things can't happen. When you're in a conversation and somebody says, I want a constitutional amendment, and I got a big apology to John Boniface here because I have been that person, stop saying it can't happen. When you're in a room with somebody who says that we can't have public financing in over half the states in 5 years, stop saying it can't happen. I'm not an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a gambler, and I think the stakes are incredibly high, and we have to fight for this. And so the question should be is you have to stop being pundits and start being patriots, not ask about the percentage chance that something can happen, but whether or not it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
The great thing about this session is that we've got a lot of time for audience interaction, which would be nice, too, because this is our last session. I would like to go down the row, though, very quickly and then open up to the audience and ask what else you think we need in place. I mean, this is a room that consists of people who do this work for a living, who are very interested in this work. What else do you think we need in place to be able to create the phalanx necessary to blast through the gates? John, I'd love for John to start with them. You're fighting for this every day. What do you not have at your back?
Well, I think the most important thing is to help people connect the dots. In other words, create a narrative out there behind changing how we fund campaigns, addressing the influence of big money, that understands that most people don't get up in the morning and before they eat breakfast run around the room talking about money and politics, right? They get up, they care about the environment, they care about their small business, they care about health, et cetera. So what we need to do is meet them where they are. We need to build a narrative that says if you care about the environment, then you need to understand how money is getting in the way of progress on that issue. If you care about Main Street businesses having a fair tax code, then you need to understand how Wall Street often dominates that. And these issues I'm talking about are issues. They're not about any particular place on the political spectrum. People just want to feel that the thing they care about will have a hearing in the place where laws are made. And if you explain to them that their ability to get the thing that they are passionate about, receive the attention that it deserves in our public policy, that that is being prevented by the current way in which campaigns or finance, then you enlist them in the cause. And I'm certainly embarked on trying to educate my colleagues that what I call caffeinating the message with this idea of what money and politics is all about is extremely compelling when they stand in front of an audience. And if we can build on the way people feel about the stuff they're passionate on, and lead them that way to this need for reform, then we're going to build the kind of broad, deep coalition that will achieve success ultimately. And there's a couple other things I wanted to say, but I'll come back to them later.
Okay.
I was appointed, I think, to one of the first task forces on campaign finance reform when I was a freshman in Congress. And I sat there for the first couple of minutes and listened to my colleagues, and then I joined in the conversation, was pretty excited that we were going to get a resolution, and then the day of the press conference came along, and I noticed that the senior Democrat winked at the senior Republican, and the Republican winked at the Democrat, and then they went out to meet the press, and I sort of slipped away because I didn't want to be part of this. And their message to the media was, we could not come to a resolution. And then it struck me, oh, my God, this is not having to do with Democrats or Republicans. This has to do with incumbency. And it's the same thing that was mentioned a little earlier on one of the panels, that with the Republican majority in the Senate and in the House and the resistance of the leadership to support change, I don't think the focus can be there with the outcome that we want, but I think the focus should be there. But more optimistically, as I said before, you need several different solutions. You need several different voices working on this. So the grassroots organizations are fantastic. Issue one, engaging the former members of Congress to also be the voice to address this, is absolutely critical. To have Brookings host this, but we need many, many different voices. And one of the things I do, and you know I've advocated for this, is a pledge to have members of Congress take a pledge. It's very easy to circulate it among the candidates and the incumbents so that there is this transparency and we know who's with us and who isn't with us. And the last thing that I really want to continue to emphasize is the role of the media, because they are the conduit. We here could be coming up with solutions, ideas, messages, polling data, etc. But if it doesn't get out to the masses, what good is it? So we need to keep pounding the media with letters to the editor, with editorial press conferences, with a whole broad spectrum of media strategies where we can get the attention of the masses, because once the masses rise up, I believe that's when we're really going to get the change from the bottom up and the top down.
I don't know what we need. You know, if I look at it like a chessboard, we have all pawns. So I don't have a particular path, but I'll tell you, we have a few more pawns than we did, say, in 1900. That chessboard looked a lot worse than this chessboard. So I am often skeptical of people who tell you, if we do precisely this, we're going to get there. I do think that we need to bring a lot of heart into it and morality into what we do, because honestly, you know, you guys are all saps for being here, right? Somewhere you have this patriotic, sappy heart that is pushing this, and you can still push it out in this arid, bloodless way. But, you know, bring a little heart into it. I totally agree with the media. So you're in Washington, you have another job besides stop saying you can't do it. Every time you see a column that says Washington is in gridlock, here's the solution, and it doesn't talk about public financing and it doesn't talk about a constitutional amendment, call up your friend who knows the person who wrote that article and say, what are you talking about if you're not talking about the two key things involving money or politics? And you can actually have an influence, because right now they're not hearing. They're hearing gridlock, you know. That's a problem, but the money and politics. I think we need to be very clear that this is a feminist issue. Far more women run for office in public financing systems, and you've seen the number of women get involved. It's a race issue. Far more people of color run and support candidates. The color of money reports are fantastic. And the base thing is it's the class issue. We have a system that doesn't allow a bus driver to run, no matter how deep the grassroots base that he or she has. So connecting on those three, I think, is also really important.
Yeah, please. Can you hit your mic?
Yeah. I think the media may be missing the next big story. If you look at a lot of the coverage, it's about, you know, the super PACs, it's about the Koch brothers, it's about Sheldon Adelson, it's about whether super PACs are as powerful as we thought they were, or maybe they're not as powerful as we thought they were. None of those stories are ones that average people see themselves in. I mean, if you're just a person out there in the country and it's another story about the Koch brothers, you're not interested in that. You don't see yourself in the story. What's so incredibly powerful about these solutions that that lift up everyday citizens is they can see themselves in the story. I think that is the next, that's the next big story out there. And to Zephyr's point, you know, if you start seeing articles about a candidate who could never run because she couldn't raise the money, like Diane Russell up in Maine, right? It was a grocery store clerk for 10 years and wanted to enter the Maine legislature, but she didn't have the money you needed to run. And then when they put public financing in place, she could do that because she could collect $175 donations. That's a human interest story that's incredibly powerful. Everybody reading that story sees in Diane Russell the potential for them to run for office and sees in the 175 people who gave her $5 themselves. And so they see that they can have power. So my message to the press is there's amazing stuff happening out there in the states and at localities where people are taking ownership again of their democracy and finding these constructive, powerful solutions. You start reporting on that, and it will have a ripple effect across the country. And you will see within 6 years half of the states with these kinds of empowerment solutions in place. So I think it really is the big story, and I would encourage the press to focus on it more.
Okay. I want to open it up. Rick?
Tell you, Professor.
If I can just give Rick's credentials, too. He was the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times and is an award-winning documentary filmmaker.
And I have a website called Reclaim the American Dream, and it's loaded with your stories. It's loaded with your stories. Now, Professor, I said 100% chance that we would have 25 states because we already have 25 states. You don't know it. Nobody knows it. There are 25 states with some form of public financing of political campaigns in America today. The media is so cynical about any of this happening, and part of it is because we're uninformed. There are 21 states today that are working on gerrymander reform and have either replaced legislative redistricting with an independent commission, or they've challenged it in court, or there's a popular movement underway. There's a better campaign finance law in the state of Montana than there is in the United States of America. These things are happening, and you're absolutely right, Congressman. The media is not covering them. Now, part of it is what you were saying, Zephyr. What you were saying is we're cynical. We're saying it can't happen. You can't get name your talk show. Name your talk show, any talk show, to talk seriously about whether or not there's a chance for gerrymander reform or campaign finance reform. It is, if you listen to the participants, when the subject's brought up, it's all negative. So we need to take a lot of time with my colleagues and the media and talk to them about what is being done, not just what can be done, what's being done. ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. There are maps of the country on one issue after another. You can get it right now. Okay? I'm sorry, it's not meant for advertising, but the information's not out there. I've committed myself to try to put the information out there. We've got to turn the media around. It's critical.
Right. Yes, and right there. Yep. The brown jacket.
Jim Snyder from the State Constitutional Convention, Clearinghouse. My question is directed to Zephyr. A few weeks ago, Brookings had one of the leading constitutional scholars in the United States here, and somebody from the audience asked him, well, what can we do to reclaim our democracy for the American people? And he replied with the Brandeisian states are the laboratories of democracy answer. And he said he was looking to New York, their Constitution Convention referendum in November 2017, and that could show the way for the future. And last week, the person who ran against, Governor Cuomo, allocated $1 million for a constitutional preparatory commission, and now there have been a half a dozen op-eds in the New York press. We talked about op-eds saying, this is the only way to bypass legislative gatekeeping power. It's such a problem. So many states don't have the initiative in New York to address the types of concerns you have. What is your position on that vehicle? It's very controversial. But
yeah, I know. I didn't know I was coming here to answer tough questions in New York politics. Yeah, no, I'm a big Brandeis fan. I also think we got some big companies we should break up. My position on the New York Constitutional Convention is that I'm actively supporting organizing efforts, assuming it is going to happen. And I don't have a public position on whether or not it should happen. The reason people are concerned about it is whether it's going to get taken over by big money. But I tend to be on the side of favoring it. I just want to, before having a lockdown position, go forward with that. And I thought what the governor said recently was good. So.
In the blue, did
I just wanted to make a follow-up point on this issue of access to everyday candidates who are not from the wealthier echelons. Beyond the point of whether or not they can afford to run for office and raise the money is the other point of whether they can afford to serve in office, considering, I'm talking mainly about the state level now, the paltry salaries that are paid to state legislators that are not enough to replace a full-time, decently paying job, certainly not enough to allow the, thinking of Florida, where it's $27,000 a year, can say it's part-time, but you can't hold another full-time job while you are a state legislator unless you work for maybe a law firm or some place that will let you do that. But the everyday person cannot survive on that salary and pay the mortgage or rent or car note.
Yeah. Let me react to that, because I believe that if the public starts to feel like they have ownership again of the political apparatus and of the government machinery, they're going to be more generous about providing the resources to make that work. Part of the problem is that if you think that the system is owned by somebody else, you begin to resent it, and you begin to punish those who are in it. We certainly feel that in Washington. I mean, the worst things you can imagine about members of Congress are being sent around the Internet every single day, and people consume that because they've decided that the institution and the members in it don't really work for them anymore. So I think, actually, that the path back to supporting people and investing in the whole structure of good government is by making people feel again that they have an ownership stake in their government. And that's why I'm such a strong proponent of these small donor-driven sort of public financing models, because if those are in place in the Maines and the Seattles and New York City, I mean, Zephyr can comment on this, people start to feel better about their government. And then they'll look at the question of whether someone can afford to be an effective representative on the salary that they're earning, and maybe they'll want to invest more. We need to invest on Capitol Hill in making the resources that are available to members of Congress stronger, not continuing to cut them to the bone, right, so that we can go do the job and we can pull on those resources to help us analyze the issues and so forth. But because the public feels so angry about it, it's easy for the cynics to come along and keep cutting away at it. So I think the path back to good government and support for good government lies in the sort of solutions that we're talking about here today.
Mike, we've already got one from you. So right there, gentlemen. Yep.
Thank you. My name is Wayne Collins. I'd like to have your comments on the fact of gerrymandering reform and the length of the campaigns have on campaign financing.
I'm in favor, and I'm opposed. The length is a real issue just because of our current court. Because in other countries you can have more of a limit. But with our current court, again, I think the efforts on a new jurisprudence are really important. And the new jurisprudence isn't just about particular cases. It's about a fundamental reimagining and re-understanding of the core principles of our Constitution. And the length of campaigns is a real problem. But there are exciting efforts happening with independent commissions on gerrymandering.
Having been part of the media once upon the time, I feel that it's okay for me to be somewhat critical of them. But and I even audited some classes at the New College of Media in my state, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm terrified at what is being taught, and I'm terrified at the students who are paying more attention to shopping online while they're in class than they are, in fact, listening to the professor. But insofar as the length of campaigns, I think that the media has an opportunity to provide some leadership here. Granted, their decision-making is tainted by all the money that they make from the campaigns, but I still feel when I say we need to talk to the media, we need to urge them to change, I'm convinced that if television stations, particularly local television affiliates, do not change their current business plans and the way they operate, they're going to be out of business very soon. And I think part of the change could and should come in terms of how much they are willing to take from campaigns. And they should be under attack as much as those decision makers who could be bringing about change.
Great. One more, and then we've got to start wrapping up. Yes.
Hi, thanks. Lisa Rosenberg. I work for an organization that covers a lot of issues, immigration reform, education issues, and democracy reform issues. And we work pretty middle of the road, not partisan, and with a lot of coalitions that are sort of the inside the fishbowl type organizations you mentioned before. And to get those organizations that are with us on all those other issues to commit to democracy reform issues is really challenging because they're really afraid that they're going to lose their advantage by irritating, you know, members of Congress or whomever on their other issues. So how do we get them? I mean, they understand it's not about connecting the dots. They've connected the dots, but they don't want to lose their advantage. So I'm just trying to figure out how to kind of move to the next level where they are willing to take a stand on these issues.
John, you want to take that on?
Yeah, I don't quite understand what the reluctance is that you're describing. I mean, I guess you could tell them that it's not like members of Congress, for example, aren't feeling this and thinking about it every single day. So I don't think anyone's going to be punished for coming forward and articulating support behind a solution. Well, just the way I like to say that 300 million Americans are more powerful than two brothers named Coke, I think that 300 million Americans are more powerful than one person named Mitch McConnell. I mean, we need to get over that. And I think, you know, we just waged a battle against a rider that Mitch McConnell wanted to embed in the omnibus, and we were successful in pushing back on that. In large part simply because we are able to bring the light of day to it. And I think that the more people in Congress are hearing that the public cares about this and that organizations that assemble the advocacy of the public also care about it, the more sensitive to the issue they're going to be and the more ready to take it up and discuss it and push back on whatever the penalty is that somebody like a Mitch McConnell could impose for just having the discussion to begin with. So I also think that the public is going to insist ultimately in a way that creates an undeniable force in this movement that these things be discussed. And in the same way that feeling from the public is being felt now more and more every day by elected officials, I think that organizations that are out there in the public talking about an important issue are going to start to feel that also. I mean, I remember talking to the head of one of the major environmental groups, and he said our group was beginning to become defeated and have a sense of resignation come over it because they felt like even though they cared about the environment and wanted to work on it, money was standing in the way of progress. when they brought the let's fight big money issue into the mix, all of a sudden they began to re-energize and activate a membership that had become defeated or had a sense of resignation. So I think the public is going to demand this. Nick, that's why the time is now. Because the broad public has arrived at a moment where they are demanding a response to the way they feel. If they don't get it from some of the solutions we're proposing, because we don't educate them that those solutions are there and put them in front of them, they're going to grab a pitchfork and they're going to go somewhere else. But there's plenty of evidence that the public will not be denied some remedy to the way they feel, right? So let's make sure the remedy we put in front of them is one that restores the democracy and what our government can do for us instead of undermining it.
Right. Sorry, very quickly with you two.
Nobody in this audience should grab a pitchfork,
yep.
John, please. But grab your computer. And I think one of the points that I want to emphasize that John just made is that we have to have the facts and we have to arm the public with the facts. So Hendrik Smith's facts, Issue 1's facts, we have the information there to arm the public and to create the change that we envision.
Just briefly, what you're doing is incredibly important. We talked about media, but working with organizations. Every voice that I work with a lot has done a lot of work with environmental groups and others to say, let's make money in politics at least one of your top three or four issues. And what is so critical, I think, in those conversations is if you're talking to somebody from Fight for 15 or whatever, you can win next year, but you have no assurance or security of any policy victory if you keep basically this is all about power, right, as the congressman is saying, if you basically leave power in the hands of 150 people. So there's no security in your victory unless you include public financing and other money in politics reforms.
Great. So now I want to, we're going to bring up Tim Romer to put a bow on all of this. Before I do that, I have to selfishly, because my publicist will kill me if I don't do it, plug the book that I have written with my dear friend Wendell Potter, called Nation on the Take, about this problem. Half the people in this room are mentioned in this book and their organizations. It comes, the publication date is March 1st. Feel free to buy a number of copies online. But it was a great project, and we're going to hit the road March 1st. We've got seven cities lined up and a bunch of media, so we'll be out there talking to people about this. Let me just say something about Tim very quickly. I got to say, Tim and I met maybe a year ago through our dear board member, Whitney Hatch. Started having some exciting conversations about this topic. We eventually figured out how to get him on board with this, and he has been like a blast of energy. He's a fantastic guy, fellow Midwesterner, full of enthusiasm, but also a lot of wisdom. And I got to say that Hillary Clinton would be very wise if she wanted to beef up her reformist bona fides and also her Midwestern bona fides and get a nice Blue Dog Democrat who used to know how to work, who used to reach across the aisle and work with other people, maybe she would be very, very wise to put him on the short list of her VP candidates.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you for that endorsement. So I came here this morning as a optimist, Zephyr, and Claudine. You'd be glad to hear that I would say I am generally positive about almost everything I approach in life. But thanks to John and his wise and hard work that he does every day in Congress, Claudine and Zephyr and their challenge to all of us, I'm not only an optimist, I am really fired up. I am really ready to go out there with all of you in the important jobs, organizations, avenues that you have and fight for this democracy to bring it back. How many of you guys are more optimistic right now than when you walked in here this morning? All right. That's a step forward. Now, I want to tell you a quick story about our youngest, Grace, who was also an optimist, but she was trying to learn the Lord's Prayer, and we all know how it ends, deliver us from evil, amen. She came to us and said, Dad, I've got it. Come and listen to me say it. So she got to the end, and she said, looked at me, and she pounded her chest a little bit, and she said, and deliver us some eagles, amen. Great new ending, as far as I'm concerned. Shows you what young girls bring and her originality. I say the Lord's Prayer the way Grace says it now, because of that optimism. And that, of course, is what we bring as Americans to almost every issue, every crisis we take on. We are a optimistic people. We don't come to this campaign issue saying, oh, boy, this is really going to be tough. Give me five reasons why we can't do it. That is not our nature as a people. That is not the way we approach problems, and that's not the history of 235 years in our countries overcoming so many things together to make a more perfect union. Let me list quickly four or five reasons why we should be optimistic, engaged, and successful. One is the American people are soundly with us on this issue. We all have heard all day long today, 70% of Republicans, 80% of Democrats, huge percentage of independents. Wherever you go in all 50 states, the people are with us. It's Washington that doesn't have their ears and eyes open. And my favorite poll on this, and what really gives me that optimism that we all need, is the Iowa Caucus Goers poll. And they were asked, are you unsatisfied or mad as hell about money in politics? 94% of Democrats, 91% of Republicans said, I'm mad as hell. That gives us great optimism, one of our early states, and taking that forward into other states to support that mad as hell and that positive effort to take our country back. Secondly, and I think Rick said this very articulately, the states are with us. You go from our cities like San Francisco and Seattle and New York City, the great cities in America, to our states, red and blue, Arizona, Montana, Maine, Idaho will have an initiative on their ballot. The states are fighting for our democracy to take it back and to empower the voter, not the donor. Thirdly, and Zephyr and others have mentioned this is a presidential year. We have candidates that have to stake out positions early in primaries, and we're hearing them, many of them, stake out these positions. I mean, I agree that Donald Trump's position, I don't know what it is in terms of solutions. I'm not sure there is one. But he has certainly ripped open the wound of money buys access to anybody. And he keeps saying it. And I tell you, I think that's one of the issues that is galvanizing some of his voters. Hillary Clinton announced when she said she was going to run for president, one of her four platforms would be campaign finance reform. I hope she will find her voice and her heart and talk even more about that issue. And Bernie Sanders, of course, is not just talking about economic inequality. He is talking and fighting for political equality for people and changing the system. Lastly, I would say, issues where we can bring this issue front and fore and make money in politics issue one. Issue one because it's not a Republican or a Democratic issue, a red or a blue state issue. It is the American issue for us to take this democracy back so we can solve the different problems in our country. Whether we're fighting for our kids in Flint to get clean water and decent education, or we're fighting for a balanced budget, or somebody fighting for the Second Amendment. Republican or Democrat, the Reformers Caucus is comprised of both parties and fighting in Capitol Hill, on Capitol Hill to advance this. So we have lots of reasons, folks, to walk out of this room and be fired up and optimistic, but also smartly engage with the media, with the politicians, with the presidential candidates on why we can win this issue. We've done it. We beat the British. We fought for women's right to vote. We prevailed in civil rights time and time again in American history. We've done bigger things, but not more important things. This is as important as it gets for the integrity for our democracy. And let me just conclude with a personal note. In the fifth grade, as a young kid in a Catholic school, a sister, a nun, asked in that class, who wants to run Bobby Kennedy's campaign for president? This was 1968 when I was in the fifth grade. My hand shot up like a rocket ship. I knew that that's what I wanted to do even back then. That was my dream. I didn't want to be a scientist or an astronaut. I wanted to be in public service and in Congress. That was my dream. And I came from a middle-class home, worked my way and paid my way through college, at a zoo, at a golf course, working and laboring for that right to go to college, that privilege to go to college. Bobby Kennedy was my hero. And my dream was to come to Washington and fight for my state and my country. So fast forward to 1990, when I first ran against incumbent, outspent, outraised, but not outworked, and we won. And we came to Washington. And I then got a chance to meet Senator Ted Kennedy. And we became friends. We worked on legislation together. And when we'd worked on a bill and passed it through the Congress, I went back to my office one night, and there on my chair was a present. And I opened up the brown packaging around it and undid the string, and there was a picture of my hero, Bobby Kennedy, framed. And underneath it was written in personal handwriting, like only he could do, "Dear Tim, my brother Bobby would have loved serving with you, Ted Kennedy." A dream come full circle. And it's not my dream. That every kid, girl and boy in this country should feel empowered to not just want to run for office and feel they can do it and their checkbook doesn't matter, but their vote matters. And we're losing that trust across the country in this system. So as they said, and Zephyr said it well, turn from pundit to patriot. We haven't begun to fight on this issue. Let's go out of here today. Let's join together, organization and organization, person and person, Democrat and Republican. Let's fight back for this great democracy of ours. Let's put pride in it and make it issue one until we win it back. Thank you for attending today. Thank you for your energy and patriotism, and let's go win on this issue. Thank you.
I want to add the appreciation of all of us to all of you for being here. I have a very important announcement. There's an open bar in the Summers room. The staff will point you in that direction across the hall. What a marvelous day. We look forward to continuing the conversation with all of you. Thank you very much for being here.